WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I would wager almost everyone believes in the concept of hospitality and uses that concept in some way almost every day of their lives. But there seems to be a disconnect between extending hospitality in a social setting and being hospitable in other aspects of our lives, particularly when it comes to politics. Perfectly hospitable people can practically spit nails at the other side during some of today's political conversations. We now live in an angry, suspicious nation where working together has almost become impossible because agreeing with the opposite side, even coming to a compromise with them, is viewed as selling out. In a country like ours, that simply doesn't work. It stalls progress in the short term and will ultimately cause us to lose our competitive edge and become irrelevant in the long run. Most sensible people would agree that we need to find our way back to a time when being hospitable is the order of the day, not the exception to the rule. So we're going to take a closer look at this today and start by meeting two people who try to make being hospitable part of their daily lives. They are Dr. James Howell and Jim Noble. Reverend Howell is senior pastor at Myers Park United Methodist Church. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Jim Noble owns Roosters and the King's Kitchen in Charlotte. They are two very popular restaurants in town, with the latter being a restaurant with a special mission, which we will talk about. Good to see you again.
Good to be back, Mike.
Also with us, Dr. Karen Cox, professor of history at UNC Charlotte. She blogs about Southern hospitality at southinpopculture.com, among other things. Thank you for joining us again.
Sure, thank you.
And welcome back to Dr. Gerard Amarty. He's a professor of sociology at Davidson College. Thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Let's begin with you, Dr. Howell. Myers Park Methodist Church, we stole this idea from you, I think. They're launching a series on hospitality. You're kicking it off on Sunday evening at 5:30 at the church, and everybody's – I asked you, is everybody welcome? You
said, absolutely.
Well, it's about hospitality. Of course they are. You're kicking it off with several speakers, Jim Noble being one of them, and Jim is in the hospitality industry, as we just mentioned, and in so many ways – so is the church, one would imagine. So how do you define hospitality?
Well, we're looking at it broadly beyond just, being friendly or and so on. I mean, we think about how God welcomes everyone. God loves, embraces everyone. So we're trying to think about, how do churches welcome people, especially people who are different? How do we welcome people who think differently or believe differently? How do we think about the people that we think we're serving in mission? Is that the haves showering things down on the have-nots, or do we have a genuine relationship with someone who is different that we both might benefit from? And we also believe it's just a spiritual disposition, that as we learn to welcome others and be hospitable, we get actually closer to God.
Do you think, as you listen to Dr. Howell talk about that, do you think he's the odd man out here? Is he the exception to the rule?
Well, I think that definitely the demand for churches today, if they're attempting to be relevant at all, is to open their doors as wide as possible. And
yet, much of the rancor that we hear about certain elements of the population come from the churches.
Absolutely, but it is a tension that they live with. Now, you can go to almost any church and have a welcome table, a hospitality center, people who are greeters. This notion of hospitality is built into what churches are today, and it is a biblical imperative. There's a wonderful Greek word, philoxenos. This word is translated hospitality, but it literally means love of the stranger. And I think that's really the challenge that they're trying to do, is how do you love people who are different from us, people we have no reason to trust? How do you do that? And that has become a modern dilemma, very difficult in our times.
Now, let me throw it back to you, Dr. Howell, because churches, as I said, are sometimes in the crosshairs. And sometimes those that appear, they are the institutions in some cases that seem to be, in some cases not all, fomenting this distrust of the other and this rejection of the other. Where does Myers Park Methodist fall on the spectrum of liberal to conservative in terms of their theology and their philosophy of welcoming people to the table?
Oh, goodness. That's hard to say.
Glad you asked him that.
We have Democrats and Republicans. I wouldn't attempt to gauge percentages on that. I know in my preaching recently, though, I've tried to talk about the fact that this rancor is not of God. I mean, people are dangerous when they attach God to their narrow political opinion, and it's what creates a lot of the heat and the fire. You know, during the DNC, we had preachers downtown who were condemning all kinds of people to hell, giving God a very bad name indeed. Religious people in our very Constitution have good reason to be open to others, not to be bitter, not to slander others, to listen to everyone, to embrace. We still stand for things, but we allow our ideas to be tested by others. We're always loving and open, or we strive for that. It's an ideal that we never quite achieve,
of course. You've told one of our producers that hospitality is being hospitable is a big theme in church circles these days. What's driving it?
Some of what I said before about it is a good spiritual disposition. There's a lack of hospitality that many outside the church have perceived in us. We want to correct that if that's at all possible. We want to be the people that God wants us to be.
You're the sociologist in the crowd, Dr. Marty. Aside from biblical admonitions, and there are some in there about being hospitable and welcoming people, and particularly wayfarers who are passing through, you're supposed to feed them and offer them a place to stay, etc. How did the concept, because there are some non-religious and certainly some non-Judeo-Christian societies that practice equal hospitality, maybe even more so.
Absolutely.
How did this concept develop among the human race?
Well,
now that's a class.
That's a great question. Well, it's funny that we were reading Emil Durkheim yesterday. And so Durkheim is one of our sociologists that looks at the world as not starting with individuals, but inherently based on the notion of mutual obligation. That human society wouldn't live if there wasn't some sense of mutual obligation. But how do you establish that obligation to begin with, right? And human societies cannot hold together if it's only based on aggression. And so there have to be ways in which we're able to incorporate people into our societies and to continue to cooperate and know how we work. And so in terms of figuring out the origins of this, that's a little bit tricky. I think the greater difficulty is that once you get more than a few people, inevitably you have factions, you have different affinities, you have different values, you have different gods that begin to emerge. And so people begin to associate with protection of their people against other people. So trust and antagonism have an interesting reciprocal relationship. In some ways, every time you have a group that is tightly bonded together, some would argue that it is always based on having other people that you don't trust or that you don't like or are the other. And attempting to then establish exchanges between those two groups becomes tremendously important.
You know, if you listen to visitors from other countries to the United States, they almost invariably talk about how open we are, how welcoming we are as a society, as a group of people. And we heard this from visitors to Charlotte for the DNC about Southern hospitality and how friendly we are, almost to the point of being people don't trust us because we can't be that friendly. The smiles cannot be genuine. And you write a lot, Dr. Cox, about Southern hospitality, but you're also a professor of history. So does this nation as a whole in its history really have a history of being hospitable to others? And if so, why would that be? And is there really something like Southern hospitality, or is it just a marketing tool that we use in the South?
I think there's a little bit of both. And I really wanted to talk about Southern hospitality as both a, you know, historical, you know, term, and then also something that's embedded in our culture and at least our perceptions of the South and of Southerners. You know, in preparation for coming here, I thought I would take a look at something that Google has called Ngram, where you can look at type in a phrase and find in, you know, a phrase and how it's when it first emerges in our literature, but probably also in our language. And Southern hospitality emerges in our language in the 1820s. And it's not surprising to me because it is at that time you begin to have traveler accounts of people visiting the South and talking about that. And then there emerges in the 1830s, plantation literature that's very, very popular, in which ideas of Southern hospitality are being discussed. And so to me, Southern hospitality in this historical context is really associated with a a class of people, the planner class. And it's depended on slavery in some ways because you know, these are the people they're writing about. And when they talk about hospitality or Southern hospitality, it's about this sort of generosity that these planters have. You can come and hang out and, you know, it's a different way of living and that sort of thing.
But not everybody could come and hang out, I would
right,
think.
Right,
right. It was for people of the same class?
Yeah, pretty much people of the same class. And so I think what happens in the post-Civil War era, that still remains part of the Southern narrative. So we have, the plantation literature continues to be popular. And what's very interesting is the next time the term Southern hospitality spikes is during the 1930s. And that's when there's a lot of anxiety about modernity, and they look to the South as a place where maybe things are a little bit easier, a little bit nicer. It's also the time when books and plays and films about the Old South are at the height of popularity, and Gone with the Wind being the most obvious example of that.
As I was getting ready for this conversation yesterday, I was thinking, as I read more and more about this, are we really talking about two different things? Is our hospitality and being hospitable one in the same? Because if you're, to me, hospitality is opening your door and offering a glass of tea and maybe inviting you to stay for dinner, or even saying, well, you're coming to Charlotte, don't stay in a hotel, use my guest room. That's hospitality. Being hospitable is just being polite, isn't it?
Well, I think the trick with hospitality is that it assumes that you're not getting anything back. And we live in a society where it's very difficult for people to be purely generous. I think that's part of the issue. Most of a life we have to organize around things that we're trying to accomplish, things that we're getting done, people we have to meet, mm-hmm. and places that we need to get to, including promotions and jobs and another sale. And that sense of how to be hospitable in a purely generous manner is, I think, one of the real tensions that we have today.
One of the places, not the only place, but one of the places that this seems to come together, these two terms, is at your restaurant, the King's Kitchen, Jim Noble, because not only is it a place for hospitality, if you're not going to be successful as a restaurant if you're not welcoming to patrons, but you're also that your whole philosophy behind who works there and what the mission mm-hmm. of that restaurant is based on being hospitable. Talk about that.
Well, just address the first part of what
whatever
you
want to do. Yeah,
the if you go in the restaurant business and you're not very hospitable or you don't treat all folks equally the same, you're already in trouble. Usually, you can tell the spirit of a restaurant. Spirit. Each restaurant has its own spirit feeling about it, and it usually is led to the leadership that's in charge. Mm-hmm. I guess it goes back to my days when I was in a fraternity, and you talked about fraternity guys a minute ago, but one of the rules we had, steadfast rules, that nobody comes in that door without being greeted. Nobody ever leaves without somebody opening the door for them, saying goodbye and helping them, particularly if it was somebody's parents. We want to do all we can to be as nice and as friendly. And even today, I find myself watching our front door, making sure someone opens the door before they get there and open it before they leave, just so that we're always reaching out and trying to be mm-hmm. open and helpful to folks. And that part of that is hospitality. I think one of the great things about the restaurant business, and I sort of speak this from a, you know, godly perspective, but there is something of a spiritual experience when you go to a restaurant. It's almost as if, and the word restaurant comes from the French word restaurateur, which means to restore, mm-hmm. not only physically, but sort of, you know, mentally and spiritually too. From the standpoint, when you come into a restaurant, you really sit down, and you may even be with someone who's an antagonist of yours, or maybe you're with someone you don't really like as much, but something about sitting at a table, breaking bread, and you almost forget the cares of this world. The walls begin to drop, and you begin to get along with folks.
That's the hospitality part. We'll come back to the other part in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talk comes from WFAE members and Carolina Jazz Concert Series presenting jazz fusion pianist Kiko Matsui Saturday, September 29th at Halton Theater on CPCC's main campus. Tickets at jazzdivaevents.com. And by the Charlotte Symphony, Christopher Warren Green conducts the Classics season, opening with an all-Beethoven program featuring pianist Arnaldo Cohen today and tomorrow in Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-972. 2000. Women's issues have become some of the key issues in this presidential election season, and that attention has brought women into the spotlight in a variety of ways, including through literature. Alyssa Chappell knows this well. She's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, who not only is a book critic for the magazine, but writes about women as well, and she joins us to talk about writing for and about women and their impact on politics Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, you'll hear top journalists give meaning to the week's national headlines. Take a look back at what happened, how it affects your world. The Friday News Roundup. Join us.
That's this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about hospitality, being hospitable, and as Dr. Cox pointed out in a moment ago off the air, civility plays a role in this. Dr. Karen Cox is professor of history at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Gerardo Marti is professor of sociology at Davidson College. Dr. James Howell, senior pastor at Myers Park Methodist, United Methodist. And Jim Noble owns Rooster's Restaurant and the King's Kitchen, which is what we're talking about at the moment. King's Kitchen is kind of a restaurant with a dual purpose. It is to feed people who come.
It is a faith-based 501c3 ministry. And we also, you may not know, we have a church there on Sundays as well.
I do know that.
And our doors are wide open to whoever comes in. And really, it's a lot of times the folks that may feel they have no place else to go.
No, it's a 501c3 ministry, mm-hmm. ministering primarily to whom?
Two parts. One, It's not my first not-for-profit restaurant, but the first one by design, because I've had some before that didn't make profits. But this one is, I hope that we're very profitable, because we take all those funds and pour them back into the community and to help try to feed the poor. Secondly, we have what we call the King's Kitchen Restoration Program. And again, that word restoration is the heartfelt meaning of a restaurant itself. It comes from the French word restaurer, which means to restore. Mm-hmm. And our church is Restoring Place Church. But in a restaurant, people come in to be restored. And we what we do on the King's Kitchen Restoration Program is take them through a Christian faith-based program to help them get back on their feet from building Bible discipleship. And it is Christian.
What if they're not Christian?
Well, then that's what we do. I mean, that's.
But I mean, if somebody comes to you who needs to be fed or needs a job.
If they need to be fed, absolutely.
But if
they want to go through the program, then they're going to have to go along with the way the program is set up.
And the program is mm-hmm. not, it's a whole training program, getting back on your yeah. feet program, but it's.
From a Christian biblical perspective, though. And we are a Christian 501c3, so that's what we have to offer. You know, I had the opportunity to be on Here and Now.
Yes, I know. Robin Young, spoke to her while she was here for the convention. You were the only thing she could talk about.
Well, she was very kind to me. I said, you know, I'm probably one of your most conservative fans of NPR radio. I started listening back in 84, mm-hmm. driving back from my bakery in Greensboro. But she asked the same question. And from a perspective, you know, like Dr. Howell, I mean, if anyone's welcome to go, but they're going to have to know that when they come to his church – he's going to teach it from a Christian perspective.
So is it like the Salvation Army? I'm serious about that, because what I know of the Salvation Army in some ways is that they help people, but you need to come in and have these meetings.
Well, if they're going through the program, we do require them to come to the Bible study every day. We have it every day. And even folks that don't go through the program are coming in.
Now, why do you do this?
Because I care about people, and I care about folks that everybody else has given up on, to the point that I don't think anyone is without talent. I don't think anyone's without calling in their life or a vision in their life. And a lot of folks, particularly, it's easier to see in the homeless population, but most of those guys have no hope. And if you can change the way they see themselves, you can probably change their life, because most of them have hit a ceiling. Mm-hmm. Their ceiling has been lowered so low that they have no hope for change.
And how do you know that? How did you learn that? Where did that come from in you?
I guess just spending time and with folks. I mean, we open up the doors and on Sundays, mm-hmm. and we let them know where we're coming from, but we don't hold anybody back or out.
Because a lot of successful people, a lot of successful business people, walking down the sidewalk being approached by a homeless person, will do almost anything to avoid contact, and you're reaching out to these people, you are being hospitable.
Probably one of the best things to do if you're walking down the street is look them right in the eyes and listen to them, know you care. And a lot of times I don't carry cash, and if they ask for cash, I don't have it. But I said, but if you're hungry, follow me, and I'll take them back to King's Kitchen, or I'll call. If I'm running between the restaurants downtown, I'll say, go to the back door and ask for Steve or Jesse, and we'll have something for you. Because I know that it's not popular to feed folks or to enable people to continue in a lifestyle. And just throwing them a fish doesn't teach them how to fish. You know, you really sometimes you want to help them reestablish the hope that they have in a God, reestablish the hope that they have in their own life. And I think everybody deserves a shot at that.
Okay. Getting back to politics, a lot of the political conversations that we have today are are couched in faith. I don't want to say that they are faith-based, because that's inaccurate, but they are couched in somebody professing to be of a particular religious background. How do you explain, then, the disconnect between being hospitable, if that is a theme in churches today, and our current inability to hold productive conversations with those with whom we disagree?
Me?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't a lot of it fear? People are fearful, especially post 9/11. I mean, everyone's fearful. So they get narrow, they get concerned about their little piece of the pie. They assume God hopefully is on their side. They attach a narrow shred of religion onto it, and then the art conversation doesn't go very well. And the idea of being open to other viewpoints, it can be helpful, it can be constructive for us, but that fear, you know, kind of steals and closes us in. I mean, it's like Jim saying about homeless people and their ceiling has come low. I know very wealthy people who, because of the way the economy has gone or what they think is going on in the economy, they come to have this very narrowing. And when people are narrow and when they are afraid, they lash out in anger. It's an understandable recoil, but it's not helpful. It's not constructive to anybody.
You brought up the topic of civility, Dr. Cox, in mm-hmm. the break, and I kind of think we are talking about the same thing. Can you be hospitable without being civil? Can you be civil without being hospitable?
Well, I was just thinking about when you were introducing the show and talking about the rancor that goes on between, you know, in politics between Democrats and Republicans, and, you know, the Tea Party, and, you know, any number of groups. And there's just it seems to me not just about hospitality or being hospitable, but it seems like just a complete lack of civil discourse. You could read in, you know, an example I like to think about, you could go to an article in the Charlotte Observer. It'd be a local story about whatever. It could be anything, you know, somebody saved a dog or something like that. And you'll look at the comment section where people are weighing in on the story. And before you know it, you know, they're having at it with each other about politics or something like that. And it's almost just like you've got to tune out from it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, and there's the thing about when I think about that civil discourse in an online environment, for example, like that on a newspaper or
where you're anonymous.
Yeah, where you're anonymous and people will say the most hateful things I've ever seen, and they can hide behind that anonymity, and it makes you really wonder where people really stand and how much it maybe they're being nice to your face and you know, sort of talking
exactly
bad behind your back.
Sociologically speaking, is that healthy? Because actually what this online experience, which has become incredibly vitriolic in some cases, really nasty, hateful things being said because you are hiding behind this shield of anonymity, is it really drawing back the curtain on how we really feel? These are the things we're thinking, not the things we're saying.
Yeah.
And what does that say about us?
Well, I'm still thinking back to Jim Noble and the incredible and compassionate work that they're doing there at the King's Table. And it does tie into this. There's an interesting connection between being deeply connected to a set of values and deeply connected to a community, and then wanting to open up. What do those values do for you? And clearly the community that Jim Noble is a part of is a community that says, we want to reach out, we want to help, we want to love other people. And that gives an overflow for them to reach out to people who are different from them, and an openness to deal with whatever that may look like. And I see that also in James Howell's ministry, the same attempt that comes out of a deep set of values. There are other people who are very threatened by their values. And when their values are threatened, then they lash out.
No, wait a minute. Threatened by their values or threatened by those who threaten their values?
That's right. Well, right. When somebody goes against whatever those right. values are, and when you're alone and you do not have a community around you, mm-hmm. that can look a lot uglier. And I think so when people are disconnected from community and their values are threatened, I think that's when the ugliest portion of life comes out.
We may have already talked about this, Jim, but when you were talking about when I asked you how did you know that approaching people in the way that you approach them was going to be valuable, you explained how it's just part of your – it comes from your heart. But having done this now for a while, what have you learned? What has it taught you?
Well, let me – excuse me.
It's the same thing you already knew. I don't know.
It's probably more magnified from the standpoint when you jump in and do it. I will say this, and it's particularly true of Charlotte. Charlotte's a very benevolent city, and a lot of people want to do something to help. They just don't know how to do it, you know. There's a story about a guy who was walking down the street, and he passed a homeless guy on his way to work, and the guy – this is – I don't think it's urban legend. Even if it was, it still is very representative of many ministries that are out there today. He passes the guy wants some money. He says, wait a minute, I'll fix you a sandwich. He goes back home, brings him back a sandwich, and goes to work. The next day he comes by, there's two guys sitting there. It wasn't long before he was feeding like 1,800 people a day a sandwich. It became a ministry. And there's a lot of needs out there. And, you know, folks come up to me and pat me on the back sometime and say, oh, it's a great thing that you're doing. And I appreciate that, but really – from a Christian perspective, it wasn't a suggestion. It was sort of a commandment that we would take care of the widows, the orphans, and the poor. It's supposed to be our marching orders. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the drill sergeant. If he comes in and pats you on the back, Mike, you made your bed today. You shine your shoes. Your pants are creased. That's really great. I'm real proud of you. A drill sergeant doesn't do that. He expects you to do this because they first told you to do so. And then if you don't do it, it's when the issue comes. But most of the time, that should be how we should be taking care of that.
I don't know how to put this question, so I'm just going to say it, and I'll probably get myself in trouble for saying it. A lot of the conversation that we hear about welfare recipients and the poor in this country centers around conservative people who would like to see welfare cut out, at least from the government. And there is this admonition to take care of the least among us. How do we do that? Why is there – most of these people on the right who believe that also profess to be religious or have their values based in Christian ethics. How do you reconcile that? Does it have to come from people like Jim Noble and from people like you and take the government out of the equation? And if so, are there enough people like the two of you and enough churches out there ready to step in and take over for the government?
I mean, to change the world, we need everybody to work together. We need government. We need churches. We need private citizens. We need lots of people doing stuff together. There's a revolution in the way church does business. For a long time, we sent food off to people. We put homeless people in empty buildings. Most of us don't do this anymore. We believe that as you get to know people, you have a different view. People I hear grousing about the poor don't know poor people. They've seen them on the street. They don't know them. And if they know them, my wife works with homeless people every day. A lot of them are they're working very hard. They're doing all they can to pick themselves up. They're really trying to do better. So we don't just send them food or stick them in an empty building. We mentor them. We befriend them. Jim gives them jobs. My wife's program gives people training so that they can stand on their own. So it's not just a handout, but that doesn't mean that you don't help people.
I would say this. That if the churches in Charlotte would all adopt one or two families or one or two homeless people, we would pretty much clear the streets.
Absolutely.
I believe that even though it's nice that our government does this, and our government is, again, as I mentioned to
you're conservative
about me being a conservative guy, I believe that it's not the government's main focus to do that. I think it really belongs to the church, and we should be the one. If the churches, and I'll say this too, and I'll probably catch grief about this, but if people that go to church would pay their tithes, and then they would take those funds within churches and reach out to the community, and not just, I mean, reach out to the community around them. If everybody did that, then we could cover the whole city. Mm-hmm. We could eliminate a lot of the problems.
Absolutely. This is not just about helping the poor, this conversation. It's about being civil. It's about having a conversation amongst each other, amongst people that who do not agree with each other. And we've reached a point where we don't seem to be able to do that. We just shout at each other and never listen. And maybe it is, getting back to what Reverend Hal said a second ago, that we don't know each other. We don't know poor people. Maybe people on the right don't know people on the left. And their experience in the world is very different, so they can't possibly really know. And we can't have these conversations anymore because we just get angry at each other. You're shaking your head up.
Well, I was going to say, one of the misconceptions about homeless people that they're all lunatics or crazy. Yeah. That's not true. Some of them are very frustrated. I mean, here's an example of a guy loses his ID. And if he stays at some of these non-faith-based places, there's a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of drug dealing still going on and stuff. And it's a rat race. They can't get out of it. If they lose their wallet or they lose their ID and they have no money and they don't have bus passes, for them to get the social service, to get the Social Security card, and then get back to go get their driver's license, it's hell for them. I mean, it's not set up that way, but sometimes the system keeps them down because they don't have the help. Now, there are agencies and organizations and ministries that I'm learning more about and trying to partner with to help these folks get back on their feet. But just left to their own devices, sometimes they can't make it, and they need some help.
I'd add, Mike, that familiarity thing is important. I have a neighbor who he and I could not differ more politically. And what we do is we sit down and we talk about it and we share openly. And what's odd is that that doesn't happen very often. You know, Republicans think, oh, Democrats are the ruin of the country. But I mean, they're people. You know, can we talk? We don't know how to disagree. So since we're not good at disagreement, we talk about superficialities. Oh, the Panthers didn't play well, or oh, the weather's nice today. We don't talk about things that matter. Americans need to learn again how to talk about things that matter. And that would be remembering how to disagree. It's a democracy.
Let's talk about that, because I was always told growing up, there are two things you never talk about, well, three things actually that you never talk about at a dinner party: politics, religion, and sex. So you can go to a pub in Great Britain and they have these loud arguments about politics and move on. Mm-hmm. Have we ever had that tradition in this country where we spoke on both sides of a political issue and just went about our business and kept friendships?
Yeah, well, I still think widening out the lens, I think part of what we're dealing with here is still the transformations happening out of incredible urbanization and the incredible population growth, an incredible number of people living in very close quarters. At the same time, these people live segmented lives. They work in one place. They go to church or mosque or synagogue, temple somewhere else. They go and play and do the gym somewhere else. You know, we don't always live with the people or work among the people that are around us. So once we moved away from a rural society, once we got our cars, once we were able to move around, we actually experience different aspects of this world. We may say we live in Charlotte, but each of us experiences different parts of Charlotte depending on where our lives take us. Mm-hmm. And so we are constantly having to learn how to work with other people. So one thing is we can emphasize either the fact that there's always so much disagreement or shouting, but on the other hand, we can also wonder that it all works together pretty well and that overall we do find ways to work together and that we do find ways of connecting with others on the basis of any number of things.
When we come back, I want to extrapolate that out to this red state, blue state national map that we have, where most of the states are red. And the blue, and they're concentrated in a certain area of the country, and the other states are also concentrated on the left coast and the east coast. We'll come back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC Charlotte's 37th Annual International Festival, Saturday, September 29th from 10 to 6 at the Student Activity Center. Music, crafts, and food from over 50 countries and a new international game zone. Plus, Audi of Charlotte on Independence Boulevard in Matthews inside the 485 Beltway and online at audioofcharlotte.com. Directions and inventory available at audioofcharlotte.com. It's the Friday News Roundup of the Diane Rehm Show. New polls show President Obama opening up a lead over Mitt Romney, who tried to reshape his message this week following a damaging videotape from a fundraiser. They'll talk about that story and more coming up in just a few minutes. on the Diane Rehm Show, the International Hour at 11. If you want to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
Make your pledge right now to support WFAE and be automatically entered to win a trip for two to Prague and Budapest. We'll arrange air travel and 6 nights lodging. Of course, no pledge is necessary to win, but we hope you will. Become a new member today or consider renewing your pledge at WFAE.org and help shorten the pledge drive.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about hospitality and being hospitable in this increasingly fractious world. Dr. James Howell, senior pastor of Myers Park United Methodist Church, is here with Jim Noble, owner of Roosters and the King's Kitchen. King's Kitchen is a restaurant with a special mission that we have talked about rather extensively here. Dr. Karen Cox, professor of history at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Gerardo Marti, professor of sociology at Davidson College. If you look at the electoral map, and I think some television network started this years ago, and that's why we have red states and blue states. I'm not sure why the Republicans are red. Maybe it's because they begin with R. But nonetheless, those are the Republican states, and the blue states are the Democratic states. The red states is the entire South, and then up into the middle of the country. And the blue states are primarily in the Northeast, the upper eastern Midwest, and then Washington, Oregon, California. Why? And does it extend, since the entire South is red or purple? Is it because
I think there are pockets of blue in there. I mean, I think
Mecklenburg County's Democratic in a sea of blue, in a sea of red.
No, but generally, it's interesting to. It's not even now it's even more specific than the states. It's narrowed down to counties, and so how can you win counties, in an election? And so, Mecklenburg County is a lot more diverse. It seems like, a lot of people who live here aren't necessarily from the South.
But does this more conservative red state philosophy, and the entire South is red, does it extend from the Confederacy? Because you talk a lot about ongoing Confederate influence on Southern culture.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd want to, hang it on, Confederate memory, that kind of conservative ideology. I mean, I think there's much more conservative in our religious thinking. I think that those things have an influence over people's political beliefs. There's a strong history of states' rights in the South in terms of, not wanting federal government to make determinations for what, local and state governments do and that sort of thing. And so there's this sense of that.
The states' rights thing has been going on since the beginning of the country. We used to be able, I think, maybe I'm wrong, we used to be able to talk about it. Now we can't talk about it because it just makes everybody so angry. That they have to get up from the table and leave because
about what states' rights
about the fact that you don't agree with me.
Oh yeah, well that goes back to the whole lack of civil discourse. I think.
Well, why? Well, how have we reached this? Is this being media driven? Is it simply what you talked about in the break? Anxiety about the economy. I know that we live in a culture of fear and suspicion, which I believe is driven in large part by the media.
Well, Mike, you seem to want to talk about politics, so we can talk a little bit about politics in terms of this idea of red and blue and going back and forth. All of these things have, I think, larger histories to understand what this is. We've already emphasized that there are pockets of blue everywhere, most likely in metropolitan areas where there are concentrations of universities and colleges, higher educational levels, higher income levels. All these things seem to be and more immigrants. Those kinds of things seem to be related to the color of particular areas. But more importantly, I think that we don't want to say that the red states are the ones that have the problem talking or the blue states. I spent quite a bit of time.
No, they both have trouble talking to each other.
Exactly. I think
it's
really
– equal.
And
on both sides.
Maybe part of it is, do we expect political parties to really be hospitable? And that might be a larger question that is underlying
what we're
doing
here. Didn't they used to be?
I mean, no, not the way I read it.
This Congress has been the least productive Congress of any Congress in about 80 years.
No doubt.
And it's because neither side will work with the other.
Well, when I look at American history, and my colleagues would be able to speak more directly to this, and I really enjoy reading about what happened all the way from the time of the founding of the Republic all the way through, all I see is a vociferous, very argumentative back and forth process.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not one that's characterized necessarily by agreement or civil dialogue.
But compromise comes in.
Sometimes and sometimes not, because often it comes down to a vote. And those votes are what determine what happens, not so much whether people agree or compromise, not the way I read the history.
But
we have famous compromisers,
but
we also have an equal history of people really.
And most of these politicians come from the Judeo-Christian tradition. Most of them profess to be Christian. Many of them say that this is a Christian nation. So if we practiced what we preached, would our politics be different?
Yeah, I think that it's conflating things that we would not need to be conflating here. There have always been in our country a majority of people who are Christian, but what that meant and how people live that out are diverse. It's part of what we enjoy about our nation. If I'm Christian, doesn't necessarily automatically mean that I'm going to be the same type of Christian as someone else. And so there's openness for disagreement on any number of cases. But I think that the importance here is not so much that religious values are not being lived out. I think it's that there are a number of other values about how we decide to arrange, how we live, what we're going to make as our priorities for our communities, and how we're going to deal with social problems.
Let's take politics out of it for a second. What about the person who is coming home from church on Sunday, and they're in their car, and they get cut off by somebody who crosses their lane of traffic, and a slew of invective comes tumbling out of their mouths? Now, they just came out of church.
Church quickly came out of them.
How do you explain that?
I mean, to me,
we all do this.
I made a joke. Somebody came to me the other day and said, you have some hypocrites in your church. I'm like, oh, really? I'm shocked. And I guess... the way I think of church is it's for broken people. It's not for perfect people. And so we know that people have anger in their hearts and darkness in their souls, and that's who we welcome. I have no perfect, holy Christian people. And so our whole business is, as Jim puts it at his church, restoration. We're trying to restore the goodness, and it's a long, slow process. But we know that. It's all about forgiveness. It's all about mercy, bringing gradual change to people's lives.
A lot of churches open their doors, but not necessarily are they open to the undesirables, because if they come in, a lot of times they're looked at somewhat unusual or funny. And what James just said is that a church should really be like an emergency room. In an emergency room, if you had to get well before you went in, which a lot of people think that churches, people think, if I'm going to come, I have to be right. No, mm-hmm. Because that'd be like going to the emergency room and say, well, when you get better, you can come on in and we'll help you. But really, a church should be a place where the doors are open to bring in those that are broken. There was a guy who now has a men's ministry down in Alabama. His name's Matt Gober. He came out of Vietnam, big drug user, pot, came back, got in biker gangs, and was probably murderous and all kind of stuff. But one day he stumbled into a church buck naked and drunk, and they welcomed him, and they started loving him and changed his life. So we have to be of that genre where we can open our doors and say, anyone is welcome to come.
Wow. Let me pass along some email comments. Larry in Pineville writes, to what extent are charlatans actually polite? To what extent are they more concerned about seeming polite? I know that in Manhattan, to compensate for its reputation for curtness, perhaps, when a tourist asks directions of a New Yorker, they get a thorough answer. I found that to be the case. I found New Yorkers to be incredibly friendly and polite.
I think that's true, too. And I think I go to New York often as I can, and it's a lot different than it was maybe 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But John Stewart was on TV the other day with Bill O'Reilly, and he said, what have you been doing? John said, well, I just came out of Charlotte. He said, I got to tell you, those folks were so nice. And I will say to all of you in Charlotte that took place in this DNC, that was a job well done. They were hoping to get 1,400 volunteers. They got 6,500. Charlotte shined, and I think it's because they have a heart to serve. He said, these people were so nice. He says, I started thinking they were sarcastic to the point I said, I want to get away from you. But I think there is still Southern hospitality, regardless of where the roots of it is. Everybody here in the South tries to be as friendly as they can. Now, can you trust them as much as you maybe your deep friend you get in New York? I don't know. Because you never know sometimes where they're coming from.
Well, bless your heart, Jim. I say that sarcastically because that is supposed to be a euphemism for you know what. So you write a lot about Southern hospitality, Dr.
Well, I was writing about it during the DNC because I thought it was interesting the way that businesses try to play up that I called it the Southern card, you know, about their hospitality and their charm and those sorts of other things. And I try to think about what that means, you know, it's like what is it about Southern hospitality that's different from just general hospitality? You know, is it any better or different? And that's why I was talking about the historical roots of the term. I think it's, you know, been used a lot since, now, and in particular, I think it's serves as a really positive counter narrative about the South, washs over the sort of negative aspects people like to, assign to the South, whether it's about about racism or, other sorts of negative, things that we associate with the South. So saying we're hospitable and there's a particular kind of hospitality. It's interesting because I have a teaching assistant who was telling me a story about opening the door for someone. And someone commented, well, I'm glad to know that there's still Southern hospitality. Well, she happens to be from Pennsylvania. So it seems to me that the idea of Southern hospitality precludes that there is hospitality in other places. And I think we all have, I think we experience different manner, with when we go to another city and I've been to New York or Boston or Chicago or something, I met perfectly nice people and hospitable people. And so I'm always trying to figure out what that is that people associate with the South and call is that it's a particular type.
Well,
of
is it a marketing tool that happened in the 1930s?
I don't know.
There's a lot of romanticism.
Well, there's a lot of romanticism, Old South romanticism during the 1930s, and it is used to market things, from Aunt Jemima pancake mix to things associated with Gone with the Wind to popular music. You know, it goes on and on.
So we don't do it any better than the rest of the country. We just market it.
I would say a little differently. I think she makes great points. Karen Cox is describing the icon of Southern hospitality. But we can talk about hospitalities, cultures of hospitality, that there are different types of hospitality. One of the things that I remember so vividly was visiting a church in Southern California where everybody gets a big bear hug when you come through the door. For some people, that's incredibly welcoming. For other people, that's really creepy.
Yes.
but that is their way of expressing hospitality. Huh. And I visited another church in Cape Cod, and they weren't aloof. It wasn't aloof. But for them, hospitality is giving you your space, leaving you alone.
Huh. But we have the charge as Christians to try to be like Jesus. And Jesus welcomed all kinds of people. He touched the people that nobody else would touch.
He welcomed everyone. I think it's a sermon that you gave. I think I may be wrong, but you talked about lepers and how lepers were the untouchables, and there were rules about how lepers would conduct themselves in society. That if you approached them, not knowing that they were a leper, they had to turn to you and say unclean, unclean, to warn you away. Whereas lepers approached Jesus.
They came to him. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, which means that they trusted him.
The only people that Jesus was impatient with were the smug, pious people who thought they were right and better than everybody else.
Religious leaders.
Jesus had no patience with them, but everyone else he welcomed. So if we're going to be his followers, we've got to be about that business.
How come so many people have rejected that part of the philosophy or forgotten it or are unaware of it?
Yeah.
Because they're not in church with him.
Okay. Put your headphones on. We'll take a call from Tom in South Carolina. Tom, welcome.
Good morning. Yeah, I think there really has to be a differentiation between hospitality and sincerity. Hmm. If there isn't sincerity, then hospitality is nothing more than pleasantries. And it seems that so many people in many places are intolerant, hateful attitudes of others who are different than they are. And another point, the gentleman before said they invite people in and feed them. As long as they'll sit and listen to their Christian ideas. Well, I don't know, is that hospitality and sincerity or just hospitality?
You want to pick up on that, Jim? Because you said that. That's your philosophy.
For those going through the program, mm-hmm. Yeah. But we have a Bible study every day, and anybody's welcome. They don't have to come. But we do have some meals when we get through. Probably 40 or 50 people come every day now. Monday through Friday.
Okay.
To be fair, Mike, any nonprofit organization that's religiously based, that includes Scientology,
right.
Hindus, everyone has the same orientation. There is an incredible amount of hospitality that you can find, and at the same time, you will participate in their programs mm-hmm. in the way they conduct their rituals.
So there are strings attached to every trough.
I'm not sure that I would automatically say. I wouldn't necessarily call it strings as much as they're expressing their deepest beliefs and how they go about doing their business.
I have 1 minute left, and I'm just curious about something that you said, Jim, and that is that you believe that social media is hurting hospitality as quickly as you can. How so?
I said that.
I think you did. Maybe you didn't.
No, it wasn't me.
Oh, well, okay. Then I'm wrong. I'll take it back.
Because people are snarky.
Yeah, you know, well, that's true. Yeah. You talk about radical hospitality. What is that?
I mean, it's going beyond manners and politeness, but who are the people that are really different? Who are the people that are hard for us naturally to welcome, and can we embrace them? Can we include them in our lives?
This all started with the fact that you are having a Hospitality Living God's Welcome program on Sunday at the church, Myers Park Methodist, at 1501 Queens Road at 5:30, and it's open to everybody. What do you hope comes out of this series of conversations?
That folks will be inspired and discover a new way of being in the world that will be delightful for them. And we'll spread this around our society.
Dr. James Howell, senior pastor of Myers Park United Methodist. Jim Noble, owner of the King's Kitchen and Roosters. Dr. Karen Cox, professor of history at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Gerardo Marti, professor of sociology at Davidson College. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is